Welcome. You're listening to Participatory Action Research, Feminist Trailblazers, and Good Troublemakers. I'm Patricia McGuire. I'm a longtime advocate of feminist-informed participatory action research and teacher action research. My co-host today is Jessica Oddie.
Hi, everyone. My name's Jess, and I'm a PhD student at the University of East London's Centre for Migration, Refugee and Belonging, and I'm passionate about critical and feminist-informed participatory action research.
And our guest today is Marjorie Mblini. And before introducing Marjorie, I want to tell you a little bit about this podcast series. So participatory action research has long promoted its liberatory and transformational goals. So we ask, without meaningful inclusion of intersectional feminisms, what is PAR liberating us from and transforming us into? So in this series, we intend to amplify the contributions of early feminist and women trailblazers in PAR. We'll have conversations about their work, their struggles, and their successes, bringing feminist values and ways of being to PAR. And hopefully together we'll revision a participatory and an action research that's deeply informed by intersectional feminisms. Today, it's our pleasure to welcome Dr. Marjorie Mblini of Tanzania. She's a scholar activist and one of the earliest participatory action researchers. I'm going to start with a brief and a selective bio. You know, Marjorie's been doing this work for 50 plus years, so I just have to give a brief intro to some of her work. And Marjorie has asked us to emphasize that she couldn't have and she didn't do any of this alone, that she's always worked collectively and collaboratively. So since the early 1970s, yes, that's the 1970s, folks, Marjorie has fought for gender and class justice in Tanzania, and she's worked with feminist allies across the African continent, indeed the Global South and the Global North. They called their approach transformative feminism, which we'll explore today. Teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam in the 70s, Marjorie organized, along with other faculty, staff, and students who were fighting to democratize the university. And that was during Tanzania's post-colonial pivot to socialism and self-reliance. Now, due to the blatant patriarchy at the university, Marjorie has said she even had to fight for the right to even study and research women and gender issues. She helped build the Transformative Feminist Coalition. They created alternative spaces in the university, within the emerging participatory research community, and within the international development sphere. Marjorie carried out active PAR work in rural Tanzania as part of the larger Jipamayo project, which was one of really the biggest and the earliest PAR projects in the world in the 70s and 80s. And she worked particularly with marginalized and often pre-literate rural and agrarian women. And finally, she joined with other women to organize and lead feminist initiatives and civil society organizations. And we'll hear about some of that work today. She helped organize the Institute for Development Studies Women's Study Group. You'll probably hear that as IDS. The Women's Research and Documentation Project. And perhaps of most import, the Tanzania Gender Networking Program. So listen for Marjorie to talk about TGNP. After retiring from the University of Dar es Salaam in 2003, she was the principal policy analyst at TGNP, the Tanzania Gender Networking Program. And they use cycles of reflection and action of PAR to build the movement. So welcome, Marjorie. It's a joy to have you with us today. Jess is going to get us started.
Marjorie, you said that in part you came to participatory action research through your work in participatory pedagogy in the Department of Education at the University of Dar es Salaam. Could you tell us about that and how that led to your involvement in PAR?
Sure. In the Department of Education, of course, the dominant mode was probably what I used to call the copy-copy method of pedagogy, where the teacher either writes on the blackboard or gives out notes, and the students are expected to more or less regurgitate what they have memorized from the teacher. Whereas a lot of us in the late 60s were excited by Education for Self-Reliance, which called for creativity, critical thinking, and so on and so on. And so I incorporated that into my own teaching at the university, which meant it was an interactive participatory pedagogy. Of course, when you're doing a lecture facing 300 students, it's more challenging. I used to have case studies I'd presented to the students, and I was modeling after some of my professors at Cornell University, where I did my first degree, and get the students excited by that case study. And then even those who seemed shy, often women, would stand up because of the nature of the case study. But the case study had to be relevant to their own lives. But what was more exciting was working with my own course at third year. It was a social psychology course. And there we could really do participatory pedagogy, have group work. The students are very involved with running their own research. We would organize a feedback workshop. Teachers who participated in the research would join us and go through the findings and that kind of thing. I was trying to practice what I understood to be participatory pedagogy. But at the same time, I can't really separate my teaching with activism about fighting sexism at the university. Myself, like many other young lecturers at the university or assistant, or even me, I was a research assistant initially, were faced with a lot of sexism at the university. And we began to reach out informally to support each other, to have solidarity with each other about this. And out of that did come a decision to create an informal study group to give ourselves solidarity as we were struggling over issues like appointments, promotions, access to accommodation, and so on. So some of them very practical issues, but also in the end, finding access to resources to do our own research. That was what led to the creation of the IDS Women's Study Group.
You have also talked some about your introduction to Paulo Freire and his work. And
oh, yes.
Talk a little bit about how Paulo Freire's critical consciousness, his work, informed some of your participatory pedagogy.
Right. Well, as I was doing this work and had my own paper on, I had a research project called Secondary School Research Project, working with student teachers going out to do their teaching practice. And I had my own base in a girls' secondary school in town, out of which we wrote a paper together called The Colonial Process in Our Secondary Schools with my fellow student teacher researchers. And at that time, we're all excited about critical thinking, creativity, interactive work, and all the rest of it, and was introduced somehow to the work of Paulo Freire. And I realized that his work on consciousness, conscientização, and all that seemed highly relevant to what some of us were trying to do in Tanzania. And so I did reach out to him. And where this was happening in Tanzania was often not at the university. The Institute of Adult Education then was affiliated, but separate or autonomous somehow from the university. And there's a lot of exciting work going on there. So as I have said earlier, a lot of exciting work of not only participatory pedagogy, but actually participatory action research was happening outside of the university. And I was fortunate to develop linkages with that as well. And of course, that validated what I was doing in the classroom or the lecture room at the university. And if I just add another thing, fairly soon, both at Department of Education and then in the IDS, where I moved Institute of Development Studies in 1980, I also became coordinator of graduate studies. And that meant I was also the coordinator of the research methodology foundation courses in both education and then 1980 in IDS. So that provided scope for me to share with students the different ways of approaching research and the significance of participatory research. If you truly wanted to have a process of research or knowledge generation, which was somehow grounded locally, where you believe your subjects that you're talking to know what they're talking about, you go to listen to them, be inspired by what they're talking about, encourage them to analyze their situation, and then begin to plan action, what we call either UTATA or the three A's or something like that. That's the approach that we use. And of course, this was very in line with Paulo Freire's raising of consciousness approach. So we did reach out, actually. Personally, I wrote to Paulo Freire and I shared a copy of the Educate for Suffragettes paper and suggested he might find it useful to come visit Tanzania. And this is while I think he had already been exiled and was based in Geneva. And it was arranged that he would come to visit. He was linked up to the Institute of Adult Education. And this was first, there was another second visit. It was even more formal to cement these links. And maybe that's an important point. I know we discussed this earlier, that there have been international linkages of many intriguing kinds between efforts to promote participatory action research in Tanzania and what's going on globally. And this was one example. It was very informal, but it was inspiring for all of us to have Paulo Freire. And he also said one of his most critical encounters was his second trip visiting in Tanzania, where he met with activists in Tanzania. Because there are a lot of critical issues you can talk about concerning Paulo Freire's approach. A tendency to somehow idealize what is possible and perhaps underemphasize the power of the circumstances, of the structural factors, which may limit what liberation can happen through dialogue.
Let's jump off from there and talk about your participatory action research work with rural women farmers that was part of that Jipamayo project. Your work in that really had quite an influence on me, because your work with rural women, sometimes illiterate farmers, really helped me see participatory action research from an intersectional feminist lens. And you've written that a lot of the early projects, women's studies projects, et cetera, that while they cut across issues that had to do with women, their labor, their double workload, whether they controlled their resources or not, that those projects didn't connect gender with class, with race, with neocolonialism, and what you also called economic and cultural globalism. So how is it that you were able to make those connections?
Well, see, I think a part of it is, earlier you mentioned the Jipamayo project, and in the late 70s, I was involved with two participatory action research projects that were really putting into action this participatory action research project. Although you couldn't say it was very explicitly through a feminist lens, although some of us were involved with a very feminist approach to what we were doing. And one is Jipamayo, which was under the Ministry of Culture and Youth at that time. And the other one was a Christian Council of Tanzania project. Now, both of those cases brought me from the university to work at the local level or to work with other people working at the local level. And in both cases, they were also translating my writings then on education into Kiswahili. But most important, of course, was being on the ground. The challenge is avoiding a case where you over-romanticize what you're doing. To what extent are you really grounded locally? To what extent are you taking the lead, or are you facilitating the grassroots animators, the grassroots activists, be they women or men, to do their own assessment of the situation, analysis, and planning action? And your job, as we understand it, as a facilitator in this kind of participatory action research, is to guide, to challenge. If that does include critical challenges. So it requires a kind of rapport where people begin to overcome our own issues within our own research process of class, race, whatever, nation, nationality, and rural, urban, and all the rest of it, and overcome that in our dialogue with each other. It's a very political process, the participatory action research. But for myself and other colleagues, we were doing it through a feminist lens. We didn't call it feminism those days, because feminism in Tanzania was stereotyped by a Western kind of stereotype as more radical feminism. And in Tanzania, at least if you're in the progressive groups, you couldn't just think that men are the enemy and all women are the same, essentializing women. It's impossible. Because then, as now, Tanzania was subjected to different forms of neoliberal globalization, post-colonial relationships, the past of colonization and slavery, where issues of race, class, imperialism were there, as well as gender. And the other thing is, we all knew women are not all the same. They're not all the same. We were taught that by Black feminists in the United States. They challenged the women's movement in the United States. women are not all the same. Or working class people challenge Marxist feminists in UK and other places. We're not all the same. You are saying women don't have access to jobs. We wish we didn't have to go to work. The challenges in the old days about WID and WAD. Women integrated into development. And in the third world, women saying, we are integrated into development as oppressed and exploited women. Now, I think I should have a yellow card. I get too carried away. But that's how the two came together. Participatory action research, which in Tanzania we began to call Uragabishi. So from the concept in Kiswahili of Uragabishi, we used the English translation, which is animation. Now, Uragabishi is that idea that, as we're saying, is that the exploited know their situation. Our job is to go listen and learn, but also challenge. Like in Tanzania, it's very easy for people to say, my problem is I don't get proper prices for my crops. Women will talk about this. I'm exploited, et cetera, et cetera. I'm blaming the government. We have a bad government. And so we, as facilitators, would say, okay, maybe, but actually, underlying the government, are there other forces explaining why the government cannot pay more for your crops or the traders are not able to pay? And then you encourage people to begin to think broader about macroeconomic forces beyond national governments and thinking about global imperial interests and so on. So that's where it is, the idea of generating new knowledge through a discussion with those who are the ones who are truly oppressed and marginalized. And this is why transformative feminists will argue, and especially our organization TGMP, is that our mission and vision is to facilitate a transformative feminist movement, which is positioned around those women who are the most exploited and marginalized. Because we believe that a true movement has to be not only composed by led. Now, that is our vision and mission. The practice of it is, of course, very challenging.
So I'm interested to hear more about these challenges. And from our previous discussions, I know you mentioned that in the 1970s, in the Tanzanian kind of academic arena, there were some intense differences between the Pan-African Marxists and the transformative feminists such as yourself, and that some of the men called your kind of feminist analysis of race and gender, particularly in the relationship to rural agriculture, as kind of divisionary. You countered that far more disruptive were the divisions between neoliberal and state feminists and transformative feminists such as yourself. Could you tell us a bit more about transformative feminism, which challenged both kind of male dominance and imperialism and Pan-African Marxism, as well as challenged neoliberalism and racism in state and liberal or Western feminism?
Yes. Well, thanks, because I'd like to leap here and say some of my recent work, like a rope interview. I remember in that one, I was really speaking bitterness about the resistance, the challenges we face. Not everybody, by the way, called themselves transformative feminists. This was more recent. But anyway, from young Marxists who, in many cases, in those days, 70s, 80s, were very dogmatic. The issue was class. So if you raise issues of gender, and even worse, if you're raising issue of race and gender, you are dividing the masses because the main issue should be class. So even my work on colonial education, where I was talking about the racism within the education system in the colonial period, as well as the classism, and yes, as well as the sexism, people were uneasy because they said, no, the issue is class. I tend to get diverted, but even a very good friend, a colleague of myself, Deborah Bryson, and myself wrote a paper on women and peasants or something like that, said, you are dividing the masses because you are talking about issues of gender. Now, if you're working with peasant households in a country like Tanzania or in a region like Africa, the main kind of form of production is patriarchal household system. It is organized in a patriarchal way. If you're looking at the division of labor and work, both work for the market as well as work for home reproduction, it is very much structured around gender. There's no way you cannot talk about gender relations. So those of us who are engaged in those issues would argue, how can you talk about the issues of peasant struggles without talking about the divisions also among the peasants? We don't create the divisions. The visions are there. That was one issue. But I want to go back to when I reminded myself of my early writings, what were the real most important struggles for me, late 60s, 70s, 80s. It was really with Western feminists, neoliberal, often white, but not only. And then more recently, it's also amongst urban middle class colleagues, women, especially in Tanzania and elsewhere, where there's an attitude of saying, our job is to go enlighten rural women about their oppression, about their exploited position, which assumes those women don't know. Whereas all our work in PAR and our own activist work in transformative feminism was arguing the opposite, that women do know. Our problem is learning how to listen, because a woman in the countryside or the town is not going to use academic language to explain her situation. So we have to know enough to understand if a woman in the countryside is arguing that, you know, these days they bring us fertilizer, which is expired. I don't have a market for my crop, et cetera, et cetera. And you come back and talk to her or them about this situation. Why do you think this is? Oh, bad government. Yes, but are there other social forces behind that? So you're pushing and pushing that envelope of knowledge. You, the facilitator, have knowledge, which you share with that person on the ground who knows where their shoe pinches and knows the most. But that also means you become humble. You go to learn and to listen and not assume you know. And it also means that you in the urban middle class may not be aware of how much you are oppressed or exploited. I remember in the early days of the global meetings of Copenhagen, the one in Nairobi and so on, as well as other international meetings, when we had these confrontations between feminists from the third world and people from the West, what was interesting is to challenge people and say, you talk as if you know, you talk as if you are not oppressed and exploited in your own positions. Chandra Mohanty, who wrote about Western feminism, is somebody who made this very clear. Can I leap into the problem of promoting participatory action research at the university for research methodology? Because I think it was, we know the dominant approach in social science research is positivism. So not only myself, but especially my MA candidates and others, even PhD, I was working with, were often challenged when they wanted to use a participatory research approach. You're being subjective. You're taking a position and so on. Whereas the positive position is, say, you're objective, you don't take a position. But we know that the position of participatory action research has always been to say, and it's also a Marxist epistemology to a certain extent, historical materialism, is to say, every approach in research has a position. If you do not declare where you stand on the existing dominant structures, it means you are facilitating those structures. There's no such thing as neutrality. But then you could be asked, so how do you, can you have objectivity? Surely we want to have objectivity in doing our research. And the answer has been, and it's not just us, it's very well known, I just don't remember their names, is if your intention is to have as holistic an understanding, in order to know how to move forward to bring change happen, then you want to look at things from every angle. So if we're challenging exploitative, extractive capitalism and neoliberal globalization and racism and patriarchy, we have to know as much as we can about the dominant forces, how they understand the world, as well as about those who are dominated and oppressed and exploited, their understanding the world, in order to be able to understand reality. You can't just go and look at what the allies or your constituency are thinking. In a way, to use more militant language, you have to know what the enemy is thinking and understand it. And in some forms of animation work, people use those concepts.
Well, that leads into some discussions we've had where you said very clearly that there is no such thing as neutrality in research. that there's always the politics of PAR, and that as a gender activist, later calling yourselves transformative feminists, that you had a position, you had a definite position. And although it required you listening carefully to local people to understand their position as well. And I might be jumping a little bit forward here, but you've said that you didn't ever consider yourself to be a professional participatory researcher, and that you weren't really organizing around building PAR institutions, et cetera, but that you were using, particularly in the Tanzania Gender Network Program, you were using PAR to build the movement. So would you talk some about that? Because I think that's of particular interest to listeners, is understanding how through these cycles of reflection and action, the Tanzania Gender Network Program used PAR to build the transformative feminist movement.
Right. But even if I go back before TGMP, because another thing is how I came into more and more the connection between critical gender analysis, which then I labeled later transformative feminism, and PAR. You know, the early work, as I understand it, the women's movement, a whole lot of it was about women know. Women are not passive victims. They are subjects acting on their own behalf. That concept on their own behalf is very important, that our job is to work with people locally so that they identify what they want to do on their own behalf. That's also exactly what PAR is saying, that the people you're with, like if we go back to Paulo Freire, is that people know. Our job is to learn and then codify. He used pictures, we use pictures. Other people use popular theater, we use popular theater. Case studies, where you create a case study and then you ask people to react to it. Interactive theater, where people do the same thing. But the job of that is not to tell people or to show people their reality, is to provoke people to think. And then what do you do about it? Like a good so-called role play might break at a certain moment and then say to the participants, what should happen now? And then people forget about who they are. They get involved with what should we do now? What should we do next? These things, for not just me, for us, really went together. Learning more and more about how to do animation, which is from a progressive position, as well as connecting it to feminism, especially transformative feminism, which is arguing the same thing. Because I mentioned that thing that the animation is progressive, can I leap into the question of how it's sometimes extracted? You know how in the early days, I think it was a progressive movement to promote. I remember in the States before I came to Tanzania, there was something called Militant Observer or something. It was drawn from the work in Latin America, not just Paulo Freire, but also work done with working class and rural activists in the United States, the role of Highlanders and so on like that. Then eventually mainstream institutions began to adopt the idea of, what do they call it? Rapid participatory appraisal, something like that.
Rapid rural appraisal.
Yes. And they were adopting a lot of the words that also were part of the participatory action research movement, including World Bank. And they'd have whole series of research programs on this idea of rapid rural appraisal. That, for some of us, is extractive. You find a way to use participatory methods like anthropological approaches to get people to reveal more about themselves. But it doesn't have the same positionality. The politics of participatory action research is you'd be working with people on the ground, but you're joining forces with them in their process of demanding change. Now, what that demand is depends on the location and level of consciousness and awareness and organizing in that local community. If you come and impose on people and say, you should be organized in a progressive mood, that's also not animation. It's not participatory action research. If your society has not reached that level of activism, you just have to take it slowly. You're promoting and activizing, catalyzing people to think about how to make change happen. So people talk about that here as the theory of change to do that. But it does show that every concept is the same with when we used to be the old days, early days of women's movement. They were critical of the World Bank for ignoring women. And that was the weird movement, women integrated into development. Eventually, World Bank promoted a policy statement about the invisibility of women or something like that. They accepted the critique. They adopted it into their program. But they were promoting neoliberal globalization against the interests of the majority of women, according to our position. So I guess it always means you take a step forward, but you have to be aware of that idea of always being vigilant about what you're doing. And I think the only way to understand what's going on is that concept of being grounded locally. You can't just do it by reading literature or social media with each other. There has to be a way in which people engaged in this practice are still either themselves or the people they're working with are grounded locally.
Well, you certainly raise the issue of how PAR or participatory methods get co-opted and then disconnected from their radical roots. I mean, I know in my own work in teacher action research, that was a concern of mine, of that these action research methods would be promoted as a methodology as opposed to like a technical method, as opposed to grounded in a whole philosophy about what you believe about knowledge creation and people's right to create knowledge, which I think comes just straight back to your premise that research isn't neutral, that there's a politics of PAR. This may be bringing us to two things Jess and I wanted to bring up at the end of, what would you say to contemporary action researchers about how to stay connected to their radical roots, how to stay connected to their critical analysis of what's going on?
But I think that's where the concept of grounding comes in. I don't know if you're aware of the work of Walter Rodney, but he has a famous writing on grounding with my brothers or something like that. Amakal Cabral and his studies of Guinea-Bissau also talked about the need to really be grounded locally somehow. When we began in TGMP, almost all of us came from a history of some kind of engagement with participatory action research locally through adult education or some other process. We began in 92, 93 and became registered in 93. By around 2004, we felt we're not grounded locally. And so we said we've got to go out, send researchers using our animation approach to find out more about what grassroots women on the ground feel are the most important priorities for them. Now, it's limited, but it's one way to check yourself what's going on. And it was very interesting because we got feedback of two kinds that was not expected, I think, from us. I think we expected people would be not only sharing their own priorities, but praising the work of TGMP. You know how you get awfully complacent about your work. But the response that came from some people are, you have excluded some people. And the people talking were members of those excluded groups. And one of the excluded groups were sex workers. You have not made us feel welcome. Now, TGMP has Wednesday seminars, which are open to the public. We believe they're open to the public. We have annual gender festivals every 2 years held at TGMP headquarters and every other year in some regional location. Plus our training, which we look for different participants. I think we thought we were open, but people in the sex work community were feeling they were excluded. Another group who said they were excluded were people coming from same-sex communities. They said also that they have been made to feel excluded. Well, that challenged TGMP, where we try to put into action animation. Is not just that we work with others, but all along, our intention then is to reflect on ourselves. So we had to sit down and reflect what's going on. And it led to deliberate efforts to reach out to these different communities. And when we did, we have this coalition called the Feminist Activist Coalition, or consists both of women's organizations, women's rights organizations, but also social movement organizations. And some of them withdrew from the coalition, FEMAC coalition, afterwards, because they said, this is against our tradition. This is not customary. You hear what I'm talking about, that when you are open to grounding yourself, you also can bring out the contradictions within your own coalition, your own movement. that challenges you as to where you stand on these positions. And what I'll never forget is the excitement with which some of our members who had initially agreed that this is against our tradition, later said, look, we are not promoting certain forms of gender identity. What we are doing is saying everyone has the right to their own identity. Now, in the previous regime, even now in Tanzania, it's actually illegal to be promoting. So there's always this issue of the politics, of positionality, in terms of governance and so on. People could say, but why are we worried about a minority? And I know the work of a well-known feminist named Hope Tejudu is, but also another friend. Anyway, there's so many. The most radical, challenging groups, constituencies within your movement are the ones who are providing you with the challenge of who and what you are as a movement. It's not the mainstream within your movement. It's those who are the most threatened.
What you're saying is so important. And I think what to me is coming through about the context of animation in and PAR in Tanzania is that it was very much designed on the margins, with the margins. And there was this intentional outreach to communities who would perhaps traditionally have not been invited into these spaces. And I think one of the things I see, in at least in from the UK context, is that there's still so much resistance to PAR in many institutions. Yeah. And I think particularly in the times that we're in now, with hostile bordering and policing practicing and surveillance, which has entered into the university,
yeah,
I think it's even more challenging, perhaps, to try and have this same approach. And so I'm really interested to know a bit more about how you were able to do this work within the university, and also any tips or guidance that you could share with researchers like myself. Like, how can we do something similar?
I think what's crucial is building some kind of support groups, people who join you in having the same approach. Like, that was how we were able to move forward in terms of promoting gender activism, solidarity, both for practical struggles at the university, as well as support for the work we were doing in terms of research. And the same with participatory action research, is linking with other people doing a similar kind of work. So I don't really separate the two together. When people are trying to do some kind of transformative or support students, candidates doing transformative research work, it's very important, I think, to create spaces where it's safe, where people can raise issues. For example, I tried to do that with seminars, but our seminars at the university were very macho in a sense that destructive criticism. People would go to a seminar looking for something to bash the presenter with, the researcher with. Whereas our work in building our confidence as women was to look for the positive strength of a presentation or an activity first, and raise that, acknowledge that. And then talked about constructive criticism. Well, yes, you have to be constructive. Otherwise, you are reproducing mistakes instead of helping people to see how to move forward. But begin with the positive. And you know, that was so hard for students and also for researchers when we would have our own meetings and seminars. When you say, okay, begin with the strengths of the presentation, and people are looking around, they're not used to identifying the strengths because people are so locked into this destructive form of discourse. I think that's a part of it, is building safe spaces where people feel it's safe to imagine new ideas, to say them out loud. And maybe they'll make mistakes, but as everyone says, I mean, a pencil has an eraser. Yes, you're going to make mistakes, but how else do you learn unless you can bring those mistakes out into the open? Now, as a professor, as a supervisor of PhDs or MAs or undergrads, I hope I put that into action. I think sometimes I was a little bit too opinionated. And it's always a challenge when you're the one having that power to put into practice what you are calling for your own self. But I think it's essential.
I think what you also brought up with the work of TGNP was the, and I think this comes from the feminist lens, is that there's also a responsibility of the people and organizations to really look at their own beliefs, their own values. I mean, you talked about the challenge in TGNP to understand the biases, so to speak, that some people had about sex workers, or the biases about the LGBTQ plus community.
Yes.
And TGNP took on that responsibility to examine their own beliefs, their own identities, you know, what part of sort of all the multiple identities they valued or didn't. And I think that really speaks to what is required of participatory action researchers to constantly do that self-reflective work. Jess, you want to wind it up?
Well, I don't know if I want to wind it up. I think we could keep talking for hours. But again, selfishly, perhaps because I am doing my PhD and I'm trying to get as many tips as possible, I'd love to hear what you'd have to say to, again, people coming into action research about how to go about integrating transformative or intersectional feminisms into their action research. And also, why does this really matter?
Oh, right. Well, I think if I go back to our own situation in Tanzania, where there are some people who will argue that all women are oppressed, they will generalize about all women being oppressed. In good faith, in interactions with the politicians and government, it's easy to sort of generalize and say we have to pay attention to women, and even when they're talking through gender language. But it's essential to recognize the fact that not all women are the same. We have different interests. For example, when you have the concept of economic empowerment, women's economic empowerment, I really have a knee-jerk reaction to that concept now. Because if we think about it, what flashes to mind is entrepreneurial projects. Entrepreneurial projects are about promoting women capitalists. That's what they're about. They're not about working to develop the power collectively of women workers, to strengthen their power vis-a-vis capitalist exploiters or traders, etc. It's about individualism. It is not about collective empowerment. And that's one of the biggest challenges, is getting people to understand, yes, women's economic empowerment, but which women? And is it just one? Because even when we were asking people in our, I think it's still being done in training, and again, using example of Tanzania, although I've left the employment there, but in the old days, preparing for our own participatory action research, we'd be inviting people to talk about how examples of how they were empowered. And people would say, yes, I was empowered to make a more permanent roof on my house, or I was empowered to expand my business. Now, that's still individualism. It would be different if it was about, yes, we're a women's group, we were able to protect our group, we were able to strengthen the beer hall, which examples are often homebrew beer or something like that, or the marketplace, and that strengthened us as a collective of women traders, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's the kind of discussions that we've had. And the issue of empowerment, I think women's economic empowerment is a very good example of how you can have very different meanings depending upon the positionality of those involved with that process.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Marjorie, for sharing just a small slice of your life's work, and particularly how jumping off from the early work you were doing with PAR, the Tanzania Gender Networking Program, really used cycles of PAR to build the movement and to learn more about the communities you were working with. For our listeners, if you want to learn more about Marjorie's work, there's a sampling of citations that are on the online listen notes that accompany this. I want to thank our co-host, Jessica Oddy. You can also see more of her work in using digital and PAR approaches with youth who have been in educational emergency settings. You can see more of her work also on the online listen notes. And I want to thank Lania Radmaker, who graciously allowed us to use the Action Research Global Conversations platform for this series. And to all of our listeners out there, thank you so much. Help us amplify this work. Send links to your colleagues, your networks. Give us a shout out on social media. Our new podcast interview with Renu Khanna will air in a few weeks. If you have any questions or comments, please email me. And so that's it for our first episode of Participatory Action Research, Feminist Trailblazers, and Good Troublemakers. Now, go make some good trouble yourself. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to all our listeners.